Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 19th of June 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, and myself, Brian Gerrish. Nearly midsummer, Mike, already.
Already, and well, Jens Stoltenberg has decided he had to write in The Guardian. It's quite incredible. Europe and North America need to stay united now more than ever. He's basically saying that the relationship between Europe and North America is at risk. It is an incredible thing that that Stoltenberg is writing in this tome. What does he have to say? Well, he's meeting Theresa May on Thursday. He's looking forward to that. And he said that since the alliance was created almost 70 years ago, the people of Europe and North America have enjoyed an unprecedented period of peace and prosperity. But at the political level, the ties that bind us are under strain. There are real differences between the United States and other allies over issues such as trade, climate change, and the Iran nuclear agreement. These disagreements are real and they won't disappear overnight. In fact, nowhere is it written in stone that the transatlantic bond will always thrive. That doesn't, however, mean that its breakdown is inevitable. We can maintain it and all the mutual benefits that derive from it. So this is another voice joining to the European voices that are, shall we say, concerned about the direction that Donald Trump is taking at the moment. He's clearly starting to look east and not only looking at Korea and China, but also Russia, as we'll come on to in a second. Stoltenberg's, perhaps unsurprisingly, Stoltenberg's comments reflected in this Atlantic Council article, avoiding a NATO train wreck. Have a look at that. Now, there's a couple of things that could possibly be at the bottom of this. The first is this. Which if we go back to May last year, Donald Trump at the inauguration of the new NATO headquarters, and it is a fantastic building, isn't it? Good value for money there for the taxpayer. But he was helping open that building.
Greenhouse, I think it is. Well, it's a greenhouse.
This is just the walkway into the building. This isn't even the building. So anyway, you can see the arrayed great and good leaders of NATO standing beside Trump there. And of course, he gave them a very hard time about the fact that they're not contributing very much money into the NATO budget. Well, Jens Stoltenberg can't be complaining too much about that because he would always like to see NATO leaders giving more money into the NATO budget. Even the UK is on Trump's hit list over this one. He wants to see them putting more money into defence. Don't think it's that quite so much as this, because as many, many people now recognising in the US press at least, Donald Trump is absolutely determined to have a summit with Vladimir Putin. And, this particularly has Theresa May hopping mad. There's no stopping him, according to this article from Susan Glasser, in The New Yorker. There's no stopping him. Trump insists on a Putin summit. Of course, this follows on from the meeting with Kim Jong-un. And the article says, now Russia experts inside and outside the US government are bracing themselves for a formal announcement of the summit, which is likely to happen as early as July, when Trump will be in Europe for the annual meeting of the NATO alliance. Now, according to Reuters today, the Kremlin says that there won't be a meeting before the NATO summit, but it still could take place immediately afterwards. Negotiations, the New Yorker article says, got serious after Trump ignored his aides' "do not congratulate" all capitals warning whenever he was due to be making a telephone call to Vladimir Putin on his re-election. Trump invited Putin to the White House. Glasser says that this isn't very likely. This is what Patrick said yesterday, in fact, when we were discussing this subject. Not very likely that Putin will come to the White House or that Trump will go to Moscow. Much more likely that Austria will host this. Trump's pursuit of a one-on-one with Putin mirrors his spur-of-the-moment decision to meet with the North Korean leader, a major policy move carried out in spite of his advisers, not because of them, and little genuine support for either Republicans or Democrats. Trump has increasingly acted like a president unbound, undeterred by the troublesome policies that would make a Putin summit unimaginable at this point in any other presidency. So we watch with interest because his determination, it seems, to go his own way is not only being met with the ire of Theresa May and the other European leaders, but also from people within his own administration.
It's an incredible situation, Mike. And of course, we've got the football going on at the moment. I very, very, very rarely listen to football, but I did listen to some of it in the car yesterday evening, early evening. So we're prepared to play football in Russia, but we mustn't have any dialogue with them as to whether we could stop the next world war. No. Remarkable logic, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And of course, how did the BBC help the whole process? Well, the BBC concentrated on the fact that there were unfortunately some little flies causing problems to the overpaid footballers in the stadium. And the BBC went on and on and on and on about these terrible little flies. They didn't bite, Mike. Nobody said they bit, so it wasn't a problem you got bitten by the flies, but there were these flies, and that became the centre of the BBC's reporting on the football.
Yes. Well, we'll come on to a bit more of that later
on. Of the BBC, yeah. Yes, indeed.
And the attacks on Russia. But anyway, what a turkey. Well, this is related to NATO, in fact, because, well, Turkey has really hacked NATO off and everybody in the West, and not least the United States. So what's happened is that Turkey now has been removed from the F-35 program by the United States. At least there's a suspension of deliveries on F-35 jets to Turkey and also parts for jets to Turkey. Well, what did the Turkish Prime Minister have to say about this? Ankara will not abandon the purchase of Russian S-400 systems despite US Senate decision to block F-35 supplies to Turkey. So Turkey, as we have mentioned before, determined to get hold of some S-400s. NATO and the West not very keen on that. They don't want this mix of Russian and NATO systems in Turkey. So the United States decided to stop Turkey getting hold of F-35 parts. Now, this is a real problem, Brian, because, of course, Turkey is going to be responsible or is supposed to be responsible for the maintenance of Britain's F-35 engines.
That's an incredible statement, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. So we're in a pretty difficult situation. Britain can't get its F-35s maintained because Turkey has been shut out of the F-35 programme. It's quite an interesting...
And it would be foolish to think that we should perhaps maintain our own F-35s.
Yes.
We should actually have people leaving school, being trained, put through apprenticeships, developing the skills necessary to work on high-tech equipment like that. That would be very bad. We need Turkey to cover that role for us because, of course, the country is simply being dismantled in front of our eyes.
Well, I mean, the F-35 is a comedy that just keeps on giving. It's amazing.
Okay, well, let's see how Westminster is going to solve these problems, because our illustrious Defence Committee has been meeting. This is the lead gentleman, Julian Lewis, the chairman. Some quite extraordinary stuff coming out here. They congratulated the Defence Secretary, Gavin Williamson, for extracting military spending from the remit of the government's National Security Capability Review. Stay with it, because this is quite complex. So there we are. We congratulated Gavin Williams. So there we are. The NSCR, so that's your National Security Capability Review, fiscally neutral nature risk deep cuts in parts of the armed forces, such as the potential loss of the assault ships Albion and Bulwark, and created the perverse situation that a review prompted by intensified threats could result in reductions in capability.
Right.
So if we put that in simple language, we've got a system in government that when you identify that the threats to the country are increasing, we deal with it by actually reducing our capability to deal with the threat. Mm-hmm. And that's simply described as a bit of a perverse situation. It's not utter chaos. It's not deliberate treason on the nation. We've got a bit of a perverse situation where we tell the public that they're under greater and greater threat, particularly from terrorism and Russia. And then what do? We start to rip the military apart. Well, the objective for them is beyond 2%. They want to spend more than 2% of the GDP on defence. And I've added the extra label here that just as with the NHS, the deliberately created chaos in the armed forces is hidden under the smoke screen of insufficient cash. So what can we give in detail on this? Well, this is a bit more. The report said this. It warned of serious deficiencies in the quantities of armoured vehicles and artillery available to the British Army, the lack of vehicle-mounted anti-tank weapons and self-propelled artillery, as well as the need for modernisation of rocket artillery. And all of this has left the Army at a serious risk of being outgunned by its Russian counterpart. I mean, this is fantasy land again, Mike, but what they are saying is basically the British military, whether it's the Navy or the Army, simply can't function. And this is a deliberately created situation for which the MPs need to be held accountable.
And it seems to be based on the premise that we have a Russian counterpart that is our enemy.
Well, and that we are capable of taking on the Russians. So, I mean, this is just the nonsense of Salisbury and Novichok. What else did they talk about? Well, they said other defence needs identified by the committee included this: greater anti-submarine warfare capacity. Now, this has got to be effectively a lie by omission, because the Telegraph, at least as one of the mainstream papers, was reporting at least 6-9 months ago that we didn't really have any submarines at sea. Mm. And that was correct. So to say that we need to enhance anti-submarine warfare capacity is simply a smokescreen over the top of what's really happening. The generation of a Royal Navy carrier group capable of protecting the new Queen Elizabeth class aircraft carriers without depending on other states. There's the key, because they're now admitting that we've got aircraft carriers without aircraft, but if they had aircraft, we couldn't defend them without the use of European navies. Mm-hmm. And this is the clue as to what's going on. The maintenance of the target strength of the regular army at a minimum of 82,000 personnel. Well, speak to anybody in the army and they will tell you that by the time you've taken out all of the logistics and the other non-combatant arms of the armed services, they haven't got enough people to do the job. So that's a half-truth as well. And then it says a layered air defence system to protect the war fighting division. This means to me that we can only now put roughly 15,000 people into any form of battle. And even if we did, we can't defend them properly because we haven't got an air defence system. So what we've got is chaos today, but it's sold as this is all going to be fixed tomorrow. That's the jam for tomorrow. And if we have a look at some of the reports, this was from a few days ago when the Daily Mail pointed out that basically our latest and greatest Type 45 warships were not going to sea. So it put some statistics in here. They can't sail, and they're taking the mickey because they've had problems sailing in warm water. Spent 80% of the year in dock. If I may jump back to my time serving in the Royal Navy, when I was on board a steam-powered frigate, which of course needed a lot of maintenance, we were still managing over 60% of the time at sea. Mm. And we're here in 2018, and we've now got some of these ships that have spent a year in port because they're non-operational. This was a little comment that went with it. It said that in the article last December, Britain had no major warships on operations anywhere in the world for the first time in living memory. So the facts are all there in plain sight, but Westminster is simply making up a story that the problem is that there's no money. This isn't the result of no money. This is the result of chaos in the design and procurement of warships and other equipment. So if we have a look at how the Ministry of Defence lies to the public, this is the slide we need. And what do they have to say? Well, this: the Royal Navy has a truly global presence with 25 ships and submarines currently at sea. This cannot be true. This cannot be true unless they are counting these little tiny university training vessels, and we're to believe that they are helping to defend the globe, as it were. So let's go on. It says, since 2016, our Type 45 destroyers have proved indispensable on global missions to protect commercial shipping in the Gulf, support coalition attacks on Daesh, prevent the smuggling of weapons into Libya, and lead the NATO maritime task force in the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. This cannot be true because, of course, we know that these ships are not going to sea. So
there's no way they're preventing smuggling of weapons into Libya because the water's too warm in the Mediterranean Sea. And aside from anything else, all the weapons are moving out of Libya, not into Libya. Right.
But this is being pushed at the general public as truth by Westminster, when, of course, we can see that it is utter, it's false information, it's lies. And yet we have a defence committee not holding the government to account. They're simply going along with those lies. Mm. Well, if you haven't read any of the material on UK column about the huge gaps in Britain's defences, this is one of a number of articles. And of course, David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives has written a huge amount of information where we've been warning and warning that the real reason we have not got a military at the moment is because the British military has been sacrificed in order to drive full EU military unification. And this process is still going on despite all the lies and cover-up from the British government. Mm.
Okay, NHS, Brian, over the last, I think it was 2 weeks ago, we reported the rise in deaths, apparently, in England and Wales through the NHS, unexplained at this point, up until today, because the Telegraph has it. Here we go. It was, in fact, the beast from the east. That is what caused the higher winter death rate this year. So we don't need to worry about privatisation of the NHS and the underlying collapse that's causing that or that's being used as a driver for that, because apparently it was Russia that did it. And that's all we need to worry about.
It's the Russians. Well, it isn't the Russians. And I have to say that UK column a couple of months ago put on an event in Nottingham on the NHS. Some truly astonishing information came out of that. Of course, the minimum is that despite all of the the defence from Westminster, the NHS is being privatised, is now very close to being privatised. And that privatisation has been achieved by creating absolute chaos inside the NHS, including using agents to disrupt and disturb the processes. Excuse me. And what we know is now coming to the surface is the real detailed information about the number of people who've died unnecessarily within the NHS. Now, this is one report that's come to light over the last couple of days, that we've had an inquiry going on as to deaths at the Gospel War Memorial Hospital between 1988 and 2000. And this whole thing is around a GP, Dr. Jane Barton, and she's accused of prescribing fatal doses of a painkiller as strong as heroin while she worked there. She's described as brusque and indifferent, and she's said to have, quote, shortened hundreds of lives with her prescription of diamorphine, according to the report. The inquiry is investigating the deaths of more than 800 patients at the hospital that goes back nearly 30 years. So we've got a sort of inquiry, Mike, which appears to have come out of nowhere almost, to have a look at what's been happening. The report's set to be published tomorrow. And I was fascinated to see that former Bishop of Liverpool, James Jones, has been conducting this four-year, £13 million inquiry into the matter. So we've got the deaths of 800 people at least, and we have an inquiry into those deaths, which lasts 4 years and is carried out by a bishop. I found this fascinating.
Should this not be a criminal inquiry?
Well, this is what I was curious about. So if we have a look at some of the information that the Daily Mail has put together, and I'm going to say credit for what they've done because there's quite some detail here. They give this timeline. I'll give you a little bit of it. August 1998, Gladys Richard dies at Gosport War Memorial Hospital. Her daughter Gillian has been complaining of her mother's care before her death. And in October 1998, the first, quote, police probe into the hospital is launched. It lasts 3 weeks and then it's dropped. In October 1999, a third police inquiry is launched. Case files are sent to the CPS to investigate. But 6 months later, the CPS decides there's insufficient evidence for the prosecution and that one's dropped as well. July 2002, the Commission for Health Improvement concludes patients are being put at risk by poor practice by the hospital's healthcare workers. And in 2002, the Department of Health requests that Professor Richard Baker, he should conduct an investigation to look at patient deaths. In November 2002, police begin another investigation called Operation Rochester. A total of 92 deaths are investigated. But what is happening is this is all being passed to and from the Police Complaints Commission because, of course, people are asking why the police are not doing their job. So in 2004, two years after the launch of Operation Rochester, the first files are finally sent to the CPS. The IPCC boss apologises for the, quote, unacceptable length of time the probe has taken. In early 2008, the coroner receives case files, and in April 2009, the coroner's jury finds that Dr. Jane Barton, prescribed drugs that contributed to the deaths of Elsie Devine, Elsie Lavender, Robert Wilson, Brian Cunningham, Jeffrey Packman. And by August 2013, Professor Baker finally publishes a report. He found opiates, painkillers had almost certainly shortened the lives of some patients. July 2014, a Hillsborough-style inquiry is launched into deaths at the hospital. And this is where it starts to get very interesting because we start out with deaths, but we then don't have a full police investigation. We just have a probe and we end up with a Hillsborough-style inquiry. Well, just remarkable, of course, that it was this same James Jones who was heading up Hillsborough. And here he is being knighted. The report in the Liverpool Echo here says last April, a jury in New Inquest found the 96 Liverpool fans who died in the disaster were unlawfully killed and supporters were not to blame. So we've got unlawful killing, supporters not to blame. And the bishop has done good work because he's getting his gong from the Queen. This is what he had to say. When you listen to the families, they say that their struggle has not just been for them and the 96, but they believe that what they've been working for is of importance to the whole nation. I thoroughly agree with that part of the statement, but it's the second part that made me think. Because the things that have happened to them, sadly, have happened to other people, and we've got to listen and hopefully, by listening to them, become a better nation. We're not going to do anything about it. We're just going to listen to what people have to say. And is this not a matter for the police? Well, this is the end of the article about the Gosport Memorial Hospital, and this caught my eye because this is a gentleman. The elderly gentleman has died. The father has died. The son has now died as well. But this was a quote from the son. He whispered, "Help me, son. They're killing me." I said, "No, they're not, Dad. They're trying to do their best for you." And the next day, the father was in a coma and never recovered. And the son said, "I'm heartbroken. Dad knew he was going to be killed." And what I found particularly poignant about this, Mike, of course, is the key question is, was he killed or was he murdered? We still have no proper police investigation to what's gone on here. And we're told in this inquiry that they're not necessarily going to pass it forward for the police to investigate, even though we're now up to 800 people.
So is it the case then that whether the police investigated properly is outside the scope of this inquiry?
Who knows? Who knows? Because, of course, the government set up the inquiry. Well, shouldn't the government have gone straight through the Home Office and said this is essentially a potential murder inquiry for the police? But what UK Column can say to our audience today is for the information that's been coming into us over the last 2 years, 800 is a tiny fraction of the total number of particularly elderly, but also other vulnerable patients, young children, for example, dying unnecessarily in hospitals, for which there is absolutely no investigation. And of course, if you're over 80 now, your death certificate can simply be signed off as died of old age. And that is what's happening. So if you've not listened to this interview that I carried out with Dr. Mark Jones, I suggest you have a listen to it on the Dispatches from the Front, Mechanics of Modern Murder, Part 1, in which Mark Jones, who has a great deal of experience in the NHS and certainly with their statistics, is talking about the reality of what started to go on in the NHS. Mm. And I'm going to add, Mike, I don't think this is accidental, because if you talk to the staff in the NHS who are deeply concerned about what's going on, they are starting to say this is part of a deliberately driven breakdown of the NHS. Who does it possibly help? Those who say, well, we need to ditch the NHS because we need an American-style privatised health insurance system. It's unbelievably serious stuff.
Yes. Now, serious comment for Brexit voters here, because I'm finding the approach of the Leave campaigners increasingly problematic. This is a graphic that they were tweeting out today from leave.eu. The sabotage continues. The unelected House of Lords continues its quest to derail the will of the people. Now, I'm not going to say that there are no problems with the House of Lords, but I am going to say that if there are problems with the House of Lords, that those problems have been created by Tony Blair and by David Cameron and by Nick Clegg and by Theresa May. And here we have the Leave campaign compounding those problems and calling for the removal of the House of Lords. Now, it staggers me that the Leave campaigners, seem to trust, up to a point, the Conservative Party to deliver on Brexit. Okay, in the last 2 or 3 months, they're getting a little jittery about it, but up until now, they have been trusting this. And here they are pushing forward with a long-time Tory and Labour agenda to undermine the constitutional arrangements of this country. And I've got to say, who's right front and centre on this? It is Nigel Farage. And if Leave campaigners, if Brexit campaigners are not able to get to grips with what is being done under the veneer of Brexit at the moment, and the destruction of Britain's constitution is one of the fundamental things which is being done under the veneer of Brexit, then we are in real trouble. Because if now we have Brexit campaigners getting on board with a long-time policy of the British establishment, I don't really know what else to say about that. People have got to take a step back and actually look seriously at what is being promoted in the name of Brexit at the moment.
Well, the country's under massive attack at the moment, Mike, and all of the information coming in and we're seeing and sifting through on a daily basis shows that. We've got more to come on the BBC in just a few minutes.
And in the meantime, the Brexit fraud continues with Michel Barnier giving a speech at the European Union Agency for Fundamental Rights. And he was really concerned that the UK is going to lose the benefits of cooperation following Brexit. He said the UK has decided to leave the EU's institutions, structures and safeguards. No, we haven't. Theresa May has stated on multiple occasions that she has no intention of doing that. She is going to negotiate the new partnership with these EU institutions, structures and safeguards. He went on to say it will be a third country outside Schengen and outside the EU's legal order. That is a fact, and facts of consequences. The UK's recent paper on security expresses the desire to keep the benefits of EU membership. That is understandable when you look at what we've achieved together as a union in internal security together. He said the trust does not fall from the sky. There's no magic wand, as I said in Lisbon, in front of the Federation of European Law. This trust is founded on an ecosystem based on common rules and safeguards, shared decisions, joint supervision and implementation, and a common court of justice. Well, Mr. Barnier, that's why we're bringing all EU legislation onto the British statute books. That's why the British government has stated that with our future trading arrangement, under certain circumstances, the European Court of Justice will still have jurisdiction. And he went on to say, if you leave the ecosystem, you lose the benefits of cooperation. You're a third country because you've decided to be so, and you need to build a new relationship. Yes, indeed, you need to build a new relationship. If you want a new relationship, Theresa May has said that she wants to build a new relationship with a greater breadth and a greater depth than we've ever seen before. This type of rhetoric from this man may get headlines in the British press, but frankly, it's all fraudulent because it's just there to generate angst within the public.
Yeah.
Okay, quick advertisement for AV9 DVDs. Those are available on the UK Column website. They're selling quite well. Please get a copy if you would like to watch these 14 presentations from fantastic presentations that were given in May. Let's get straight on to this. We have only, well, in fact, I think we've probably got about 19 hours left to save the world, as it were. This is Save Your Internet, Heroes or Zeros. We mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. Two new pieces of legislation. It's the European Digital Single Market Directive on copyright, originally published in 2016. Two articles in that are of particular concern. One is the filtering of all uploads to the internet on copyright grounds. So this is a broad-based filtering system, which is under Article 13. But the more serious one, in my opinion, is Article 11, which is a link tax. The link tax proposal, which establishes a special copyright-like fee to be paid by websites to news publishers in exchange for the privilege of using URLs in articles and so on. The key point about this was, aside from as despicable as that is on its own, the key point about this was that this was being couched in the language of being an unalienable right, which means that even if a news publisher was prepared to waive the so-called link tax, waive the fee on this, it would be unlawful for them to do so. So, look, I'm seeing lots of people pushing out stuff like this: stop the censorship machine, delete Article 13, which is mainly concerned about the sort of YouTube copyright claim style scanning of every piece of content which is uploaded to the internet. That is bad enough, but I think Article 11 is the one that deserves the greater concern. But not very long now, just today, to get in contact with any members of the European Parliament that you might want to contact to try to convince them to vote against this.
And why do we need to do that? Let's have a look at our own BBC, and I'm going to thank the person who highlighted this to me a few days ago. This is BBC Radio 4 Advertising Dangerous Visions, First World Problems. Martin Jameson's five-part drama draws on detailed research to create a compelling account of the consequences of a UK civil war. I don't know what would happen, Mike, if UK Column put on a programme talking about a civil war in UK, but I think we would have somebody knocking on our door pretty quickly. But this was just a stunning piece of malicious work by the BBC. And let's follow it through a bit. I've just said sinking to a new low. It's almost getting impossible to know how to describe the BBC. I followed this through mainly on Twitter because I went to have a look at Martin Jameson's Twitter page, Smart Arts. This was one of the tweets here from BBC Radio Drama. Catch up with the first instalment of First World Problems, a compelling and human account of what civil war in Britain could do to us all. And somebody posted underneath a compelling and disturbing drama about the breakdown of society in UK. This is the BBC at its most dirtiest. Think of what BBC Media Action was boasting about in Syria, that they worked with the so-called opposition to help destabilise the country to get rid of Assad. And here at a time when everybody knows the tensions increasing in this country as a result of the lies and mismanagement by the British government, what does the BBC start doing talking about a civil war? Well, my response was to, if you like, get in the face of this team. So I posted some comments on Martin Jameson's Twitter page. I've had a look today. I think some of it has been removed somehow. I'm not quite sure how that's been done. But I basically said that this was another dangerous production by the BBC death cult team. War in Syria is almost over, so let's get the idea of a war in UK started. This is mass propaganda, reframing the nation for unrest, and that's what absolutely what I think this is. There was a tweet that I found where Martin Jameson is snickering about this and promoting it the death cult bit as being quite a good label for the BBC. So just astonishing. Here's the team. I think the gentleman on the right is Martin Jameson. He seems to fit his own Twitter image. And what do we describe these people as? Smirking, giggling. I mean, they're not very old. Do they really understand what they're doing here? But it's the arrogance of the team that's put this together, that as we know that under the surface, all sorts of tension in this country, this is what the BBC is promoting. So this is another tweet that I came across. Let me just bring this up on screen. So this is part of the debate. Horrified by recent political turmoil, have a listen to this, quote, fantastic radio drama about a new British civil war. It'll shit you up. Apologies for that. It'll shit you up even more. It's like a Threads for the Modern Age. Now, this expression was then pushed around by a number of people as a good description of what this programme is about. I posted some comment. I described on the Twitter page that it was utterly disgusting. Real war is death, destruction, suffering. And for you, it's a joke, as it'll shit you up. This is BBC language, not UK column. And I reminded them of what BBC Media Action had been doing in Syria. So, Mike, this stuff is just almost unbelievable, that we've got £3.74 billion of government propaganda machine helping to promote war and violence, not overseas now, but to do it inside UK. And I'm going to really encourage our audience today to respond to this. Get onto the Radio 4 Twitter page, make comment, reasonable, measured comment as to what the BBC is doing here, and challenge the individuals that have produced this stuff. The agenda is to ramp up civil unrest in this country. It's the reason that we've been warning and warning about people getting involved in any form of violence on the streets, because of course, if there is that violence, the UK government can crack down with all of the assets that it's put together. And if you want a good example of the danger of that situation, perhaps we should focus on Devon and Cornwall Police's own Sergeant Tangi, who clearly is desperate to be able to use his automatic weapon on the streets of Britain. So really dangerous stuff, Mike, and from the BBC, just utterly appalling.
Okay, Theresa May yesterday held a roundtable for social enterprise chief executives in Downing Street. It had the likes of people from Social Enterprise UK, Big Issue, Community and Social Enterprise, Crown Representative, Voluntary Community and Social Enterprise, Tamil Community Housing Association, the Big Issue Group, as I say, London Early Years Foundation, Big Society Capital, ADAPT, Rochdale Borough-wide Housing, and so on. Very interesting. So the press release says this afternoon the Prime Minister hosted social enterprise CEOs and leaders from a range of sectors, including education, health, transport and housing, for a roundtable on Downing Street. And this was really what she was saying. My vision is for a society that focuses on the responsibilities we have to one another, and where all sectors, not just the state, play their part in tackling the challenges facing this country. Now, what were they discussing? Procurement, how the government can protect and expand the role social enterprises can and should play in a public service economy. But look, what is this about? It is the fusion doctrine being developed in front of our eyes. It has been being developed for a long time, but at the heart of it is communitarianism. This is the third way, Tony Blair's third way, which became David Cameron's big society. It's now Theresa May's fusion doctrine. It's communitarianism, a compromise between capitalism and communism. Communitarianism is not fascism, nor is it communism, but it's a synthesis of these opposing ideologies which preceded it. It draws government business partnerships from fascism and employs group decision making from communism. It resembles a corporate state in which the elite will work under capitalist rules to continue generating wealth, while the working class will be controlled by communist model laws. The communitarian synthesis incorporates not only elements of fascism and communism, but also globalism. And of course, communitarians believe that attaining a healthy society involves the successful merger of all three sectors of society. That's the public sector, the private sector, and the charity sector, the social enterprise sector. We have published a number of articles on this over the years. Here's one from 2010, Our Common Community, another one from 2010, Abusing the System Through NGOs and CSOs. Another one from 2010, Lifting the Veil of Secrecy, one from 2011, just called The Big Society. And not just us talking about it, this is James Dellingpole in The Spectator saying communitarianism is a freedom-hating totalitarian philosophy like any other. This is what is being built around us at the moment. While this seemed like a very gentle little meeting of Theresa May, a little round table with Theresa May and all these chief executives from civil society, this is what she's building, and it's not pleasant.
It's extremely unpleasant, and the language is so important, Mike, because many of the words that the government ministers and civil servants are using, these are words where we think we know the meaning of the words they're using, but in fact the words are being used in a different way. An example is independence, which of course is being bandied about north of the border. Most people in Scotland believe that means full independence for Scotland, but of course it doesn't. It simply means a brand of independence inside the European Union. Language is key to this, understanding it.
Yes. Now, a quick reminder that Reverend Andrew Ashdown is speaking in the Rye Bakery in Frome and Somerset on Friday night, beginning at 6 p.m. I'll be there. Hope to see as many people there as possible. Matthew Hancock has been up to his tricks again. This time he's launched a call for evidence for the future telecoms infrastructure review. That was announced last month in the industrial strategy, the so-called industrial strategy. This is a cross-government review, apparently, led by the Department for Culture, Media, and Sport, Digital Culture, Media and Sport, and it's going to assess whether any additional policy interventions are needed to create conditions for long-term investment in world-class digital connectivity that is seamless, reliable, long-lasting and widely available. Now, when I read that, any additional policy interventions, I was interested to know what he was talking about. But anyway, here's what he said. We in the government are absolutely determined to ensure the country has the telecoms infrastructure it needs to meet the needs of consumers and businesses today and in the future. We're also determined to be a world leader in the deployment of 5G mobile technology. And when I had a look at the documentation that goes alongside this, it says that 5G has the potential to transform the way people and businesses use wireless connectivity, but it is a technology in development. Investment in the rollout of 5G-ready networks should be led by the private sector, but the business case is as yet uncertain. So we're looking at perhaps a fusion doctrine here as well. As set out in our 5G strategy, we recognise, he said, there is an important role for government to play in ensuring that the conditions are in place to encourage this investment. Alongside this call for evidence, we have published an update on progress against delivering the actions from the 5G strategy and set out further detail on the areas that we will focus on to support the deployment. We will also consider with Ofcom the spectrum allocation and licensing regime to support 5G deployment. But here's the point. As this goes on, it says this, that they will support 5G network deployment pilots in urban and rural areas by testing approaches to infrastructure sharing, identifying the practical barriers and challenges to deployment, and stimulating demand for new kinds of applications and services. And So they're talking about infrastructure sharing. They're talking about alternative market structures. And so what they're really talking about is they're so determined, they appreciate that 5G is quite possibly, as it's currently architected, quite possibly too expensive to have a competitive market like we perhaps have at the moment in the mobile telecom space. And so the government is going to have to step in and create the 5G infrastructure. And we end up with this model of non-competition like we have with water and energy suppliers at the moment, where we have a shared infrastructure and this sort of negative competition model that sits on top, which means prices are controlled. Again, we're looking at communitarianism here.
Yeah, because ultimately this system is going to be used to control people. So you don't want a number of hands in the pot. You want the control to rest solely with the government. Mm. Well, the UK column has warned and warned for many years that the problems people were experiencing at the bottom of the pile, for want of better words, was also going to affect people higher up. And that is clearly now happening. But we're going to end on some good news. So somebody who's been under fire recently is Noel Edmonds. He's had his business attack. Well, his business collapsed as a result of fraud and corruption in the banks. He is making a very, very big noise about this. Business Matters here has got a very good article talking about fraud and corruption in the banks. But Noel Edmonds is one of the people now who stepped forward to actually talk about what's going on. We say that nobody is safe from the scale of the fraud and the criminal activity in the banks. And of course, we need people with high profile in the media in general to be seen to be speaking out. So we're going to say to Noel Edmonds, well done. We know that you've put in a lot of hard work to get this thing into the wider press. But we also want to say that this man, the Police and Crime Commissioner for Thames Valley, Anthony Stansfield, has also been doing really outstanding work. And he is making some statements which we've never seen anybody else brave enough to say. So in the article I've just quoted, he says this: I find it quite extraordinary that the chairman of the Financial Conduct Authority was the senior partner of KPMG that did the audits of HBOS Bank. They overlooked £1 million fraud and a multi-billion pound hole, probably approaching 40 billion in the accounts. And yet the man went on to become chairman of the Financial Conduct Authority. So the Police and Crime Commissioner here absolutely pointing out this circular system we have where people move through the banks into the auditing companies, into the regulators. And now it's emerged that there is massive fraud and corruption going on. He is standing up to be counted. So what a tremendous guy this is. He goes on to say this: people with small debts were bankrupted, then had their assets stolen off them that are worth many times their original debt. And that is divided up between the cronies. In my view, the insolvency practitioners and others, and vast sums of money simply disappears. Where did all the money go from the HBOS case? I think probably at least 600 or 700 million went straight abroad. I think we've only recovered 15 million out of a vastly bigger sum. Who made the money and where is it sitting? So this gentleman has really nailed his colours to the mast. He's talking about not only the fraud and corruption in the banks, but he's talking about the failure of the big auditing companies to tell the truth. And he's also talking about the failure of the government to get to grips with what's going on here. And what he's also pointing out is that where the police attempted to get to grips with this, of course, the police and the fraud office itself simply didn't have the resources to get in and mix it in this scale of fraud. So he's also calling for major changes to the fraud system in order to hold these banks to account. Mm. I've got to say, Mike, this is another person who I think the courage it's taken actually for somebody in his position to come forward and start talking about this is really incredible. And I know that one of the things he's experiencing at the moment, of course, is not a lot of help and support from members of parliament or the government departments, such as the Treasury, which you would have expected in a proper world to have said, well, we've got to get to the bottom of what's going on here. So probably we'll end by saying to our audience today, this man, like John Wedger, is a man who's been prepared to stand up and be counted. He needs praise and support from the general public to push through the good work that he started. It's happening though, Mike. We are now starting to see people standing up to be counted. Noel Edmonds, of course, because of the personal hit that he's taken. But this police and crime commissioner is simply doing it because, as he says, this is criminal activity and it's got to be stopped. We'll end there. Thank you very much for joining us. And a very big thank you to people who've sent us some donations over the last few days. This is greatly appreciated. And of course, it's your support that keeps us going. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.